Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pools in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75, 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And so you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. Even though you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never change anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
But you say, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, "Shoot it!" So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
All right, time for another installment of It's My House. In today's episode, and we got over 1,500 of these over 6 years. Today's episode is titled America's Greatest Champion. We have in our studio Terry M. Iverson. Live stream number 619-768-2945. That's 619-768-2945. Now, we're going to take a quick little musical interlude so you can go to Amazon, look up Terry M. Iverson. You can download his book or even get a free I think you can read maybe a chapter or two for free. But, you know, so you can follow along with us. So that today's topic, America's Greatest Champion, we're going to be talking about manufacturing, okay, which is something that we want to talk about more on this podcast. On that note, go to Amazon, America's Greatest Champion, Terry M. Iverson will be on in a few minutes.
Waving your banner all over the place. We will, we will.
Okay, technical difficulty cut off the song, but in any event, today's podcast, Four Champions, the title of today's podcast is America's Greatest Champion by Terry M. Iverson, and he has a book on Amazon titled Finding America's Greatest Champion, Building Prosperity Through Manufacturing, Mentoring, and the Awesome Responsibility of Parenting. And all that's relevant, but I want to target in on manufacturing and all through the book. In any event, let's open up Terry's mic. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine, fine. Before we get into your book, tell us a little bit about yourself and the family business. How did that get started?
Well, my family got involved in the manufacturing sector my grandfather in about 1925. We're in the machine tool industry, and we have a machine tool distributorship, rebuilding and service providing company that is 90 years old this coming year. And this is my 40th year. But we reside in the Chicagoland area, and my grandfather's started in manufacturing, you know, as I said, 1925 for a machine tool builder. And that machine tool builder moved to New York State, and he was offered a chance. He was one of three people offered a chance to move, and he graciously declined. And he stayed back, and he started up our company back in 1931.
Now, what was he making or manufacturing like on day one?
Well, when he started, he was very young. He went to work to support his brothers, sisters, and mother. His father had passed away. So he ended up quitting school, I believe, at 16, and he went to work a machine tool builder. It was a lathe manufacturer that does turning, and he was basically sweeping the floors in the very beginning. And then they realized, you know, our family's been very, very lucky to be very good in math and science. And they realized that he had a lot of skills and talents that they didn't even know about when they hired him. So he got into the engineering with you know, very little education, just, you know, raw natural aptitude. And he did very well. And when the company was sold and moved to New York, he was actually offered a position to go with. And because of family, he had to decline. But that was the start of our manufacturing legacy.
Great. All right. So now then he had either your father or your mother. He had children. Now, who followed in his footsteps from there?
Well, my grandfather had three sons, my dad and my two uncles, and they all followed into manufacturing in one shape or form or another. My dad started working for the family business, which I then in turn started working for him as a young man. And my uncles, one ended up working in the company and then going out and buying a machine shop. And then my other uncle, that was a younger uncle, John, and then the older uncle, Ed, who unfortunately just passed away, he started a machine shop some 60 some odd years ago. And so they were in manufacturing. Then there was a whole litany of relatives, cousins, and second cousins, and the like that ended up also in manufacturing careers as well.
Okay. And then how did we go into the next generation? This is third generation, right?
I'm the third generation, and this is my 40th year, and I have three children, and one daughter and two sons. And our middle child, our daughter, worked for us for about 6 years, and our oldest son worked for us for about 3 years, and then they moved into other careers.
Now, how did you enter into the business?
Well, the last thing I was going to do and the last thing I thought I wanted to do was work for the family business and work for my father. My father's a very, very perfectionist, And I wasn't sure that that would work, but as luck would have it, it did work out. But I thought I wanted to get into various things, and it was not until my junior in college, I said, you know, I'm really good in math and science. Why don't I, you know, go down the engineering path? So I did, and then I ended up getting married. My wife and I got married our third year in college. And then I went to work for my uncle originally at a machine shop. And then about 10 months later, my dad offered me a position in outside sales, which I took, you know, some 40 years ago.
Okay. All right. We're talking about generational wealth now. With your children, as a matter of fact, is there anything within the family business where you guys are thinking like 52 or 100 years out on how we can pass this down to the next generation?
Boy, that's a really good question. I mean, it's something I struggle with now. I'm on probably my sixth succession planning model, and I'm not really sure how to answer that question. Over a year ago, I had an article written in the Chicago Tribune about succession planning. And in the technical world, in the manufacturing world, it's difficult because we can't get enough skilled workers as it is. And sometimes that applies to our own offspring, and sometimes it, you know, just getting, you know, workers involved in the manufacturing sector alone is difficult.
And that's one topic, manufacturing. We talked a teeny bit about it over the last 6 years. I wish somebody would have pulled my chain when I was 15 or 16 about start making stuff. Only thing I've made prior to an Erector set or arts and crafts, I haven't made anything since like 8 years old.
Well, it can be now, very rewarding, as you probably know.
Yeah. So now I'm looking at, because my mother passed away a little bit over a year ago, so she left behind, she wasn't an official seamstress, but she had the skill set of it all because nursing was her bread and butter. But she left behind a house full of clothes that she made, three sewing machines that I've been able to find so far, and my interest is housing. So at the suggestion of a friend of mine, and I started studying tents and nomadic architecture. So that's my plan on making tents. Now let's get into your book first. What is your book about?
Well, you know, Finding America's Greatest Champion, my first concept is that manufacturing is America's greatest champion. And I started a 501c3 called Champion Now, and Champion is an acronym which stands for Change How American Manufacturing is Perceived in Our Nation. And the now is the call to action to do something about it. But I also go into the book and define that America's greatest champion is the next generation of young people that are our future, and that the female gender in the workforce, which is definitely underrepresented in the manufacturing sector. I think 26 or 27% are some of the actual percentages of women in manufacturing. I think it's much lower than that, but that's the number I researched. And mentoring young people has always been important to me. I was a travel soccer coach for about 25 years, and I was mentored as a young person because I grew up with a single parent. My mom raised me in Florida. And then parenting. I think parenting in this country, I think we've gotten away from, you know, holding our children accountable. I think too many people try to be their child's best friend, and they don't realize how much harm or how much, you know, the child is not benefiting from that. And so I say in the book, in various, I have 50 different interviews in the book, from mostly from acquaintances, friends, and family. And if we did a better job of parenting and mentoring our young people in this country, I think they would probably be ideally suited for everything. But I think the manufacturing sector and the young people and the opportunities the young people have in the manufacturing sector would help our student debt crisis and help our country prosper.
Yeah, I agree. Now, you said you were a soccer coach?
I was a travel soccer coach. I played ball as a young man, and most of my adult life, I coached travel soccer and mentored young people, both young men and young women, on soccer teams. And then when I retired, I decided to take that mentorship mentality and bring it into the manufacturing and education sector, and ultimately that's what led me to write the book.
Yeah, the reason why that I'm fascinated by you are a soccer coach. A lot of people, it's all over the, I mean, they have cable network channels dedicated to this. They speak about various professional athletes, basketball, football, soccer, you name it. And they talk about the salaries that some of these higher profile athletes, professional athletes make. But I never hear a conversation on the manufacturing side of sports. Who makes the basketball? Who makes the uniforms? Who makes the shoes, the shoelaces, the socks? And there's millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, in that. Does your program touch on any of that? Because that's like to me, it's like a missing link as far as the educational piece goes.
Well, there's a lot of correlations that can be made and examples that can be made of sports. I think team sports is unbelievably beneficial to young people and in that how it allows you to understand how to be a part of something bigger, how to work as a team, and how to be, you know, a member of an organization. From a manufacturing standpoint, I talk in the book that there's so little appreciation in our country, in our culture, about manufacturing in general that we just don't think about it enough, and we don't think about how important it is. But that correlation to, you know, footballs, basketballs, helmets, you know, pads, hockey sticks, and everything else has a lot of, you know, it's a very valid point. Point you made earlier, in the housing market, I make a correlation with metalworking, and I make the correlation to actual woodworking and woodworking to home building. One of my friends who I coached his son in travel soccer was a builder. And so he talks about the lack of skilled workers in the building, home building market as well.
Okay, true. Well, because I'm 62. Most of the friends I would say all of them that I came up with, even with college degrees, some with advanced degrees, master's, JDs, and all that, don't know how to make anything. During this pandemic time, I'm learning how. So, two questions. What would you recommend for a teenager as well as somebody midlife or whatever kind of life, if they want to make, when I'm going to use a generic term, widgets, okay? What are the first steps that you suggest that they take in the pursuit of making widgets, whatever that might be?
Well, I make a lot of points in my book about education, and I'm an advocate of all education, but some education is not attainable or realistic, And there's a lot of 4 and 5 year degrees that cost a lot of money. And you come out of that, and sometimes the job market is saturated in that particular field. In manufacturing, you can get into a 2 year community college degree or certification process, come out with a lot less cost in the education, but a lot more opportunity in terms of positions that are looking to be filled, and good salaries on top of that. So if you wanted to get involved in manufacturing, or at least understand what it is, I tell the young people when I talk at schools all around the country that, you know, with Google and with YouTube, you can search anything you could possibly want to learn about. So there's one individual that is interviewed in my book by the name of John Saunders, and he has a YouTube channel called NYC CNC, and he taught himself manufacturing. He was initially, I think, in New York, and then he moved to Ohio. But it was one of the few people I interviewed in the book that I didn't know, and I introduced myself because he has this tremendous following about how he taught himself manufacturing, and now he is a manufacturer of all sorts of goods and products. So that being said, you know, engineering, there's 4 plus 5 year degrees in engineering. There's 2 year degrees in community colleges and technical colleges all around our country. In high school, there's Project Lead the Way classes that you can learn about manufacturing and engineering in high school. And then lastly, there is a very prominent push in this country now for internships. And manufacturing is taking, a good look at, you know, embracing internships from sophomores, juniors, and seniors in high school. Lastly, or one other facet is the German-American Chamber of Commerce is starting to make apprenticeships alive and well back in this country.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed when I was in Germany, they're a little advanced ahead of us. Now, this guy's name was, mm-hmm. we say, John Saunders?
John Saunders, and he has a very well-followed and subscribed YouTube channel called NYC CNC, I believe.
Just found it. Okay, excellent tip. Now, I've been, for the last, even before this COVID thing popped up, mm-hmm. On this podcast, I've been playing some audios of manufacturing over in China, and mm-hmm. This one particular audio, it's called Factory City. People can purchase it off Amazon, or you can watch it for free on YouTube. I was so fascinated. I don't play it at least 20 times on this podcast this year alone, but. What I was fascinated was within that culture, and I'm sure they have, I guess, hopefully something like this over here, where they have, and matter of fact, I had to give credit to one of our regular listeners, Mr. Pianchi, that turned me on to it. You have some townships over there or some villages that the only thing they might produce might be neckties. On the factory audio that we play on here out of China, it's like they might have a team of 25 to 35 people on a team, and they might have 60 to 70 teams, and they're cranking out 700 to maybe 2,000 coffee pots or grillers per day. So now, and in those communities, they have dormitories there if you're single. They have apartments there if you're married and you have a family. I guess over here you would call it a company town. So are there any company towns still existing in the United States?
Okay, there's so much that you just said that I'll try to be brief.
I've been waiting on this for a long time.
No. I want to give you the best value add comment I can give you. One of the most well-known examples in China that you're talking about is the company called Foxconn. And
that's
I talk
it.
About Fox.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, I talk about
right.
Foxconn in my book. They just opened up a facility up in southern Wisconsin. But Foxconn, for the people who are listening, is the primary supplier and manufacturer of Apple products in the world. And Foxconn has, I believe, 1 million workers that are in one of these factory cities that you call, that you refer to. And the whole city is pretty much the company and all their million workers. So to answer your question as best I can, we have similar scenarios, but certainly not to that degree. We have, I would call them clusters. And the best example I can give you of a cluster is Warsaw, Indiana. Warsaw, Indiana is one of the leading centralized examples of orthopedic equipment and devices in the world or in the country. And so you have some of the most, the top names in orthopedics, Zimmer, Biomet, Medtronic, DePuy, to name a few, that are all located in a very small town in north central or northeast Indiana. So the other thing that I'll say is I have a little bit of background in Taiwan. I traveled to Taiwan and I visited machine tool builders. And in Taiwan, for machine tools, they'll do the same thing. And some of this commentary may or may not make sense. But on a lathe, you have something called the turret. And on a machining center, which is a mill, you have something called a tool changer. And you'll have companies in Taiwan that'll make just turrets and other companies that'll make just automatic tool changers. And they'll sell to, you know, dozens or if not hundreds of builders, just the turrets for one company and just the automatic tool changers for another. So that's kind of two examples, one in China and a couple in Taiwan, and then one carryover into the U.S. of kind of what we have in the U.S., but it's really not the same.
Okay. All right. Well, now, you're on here. Now, your company, could you go a little bit more detail on your company and what do you guys make?
Well, we're not so much of a manufacturer as we are a distributor and a rebuilder. So technically, we remanufacture small lathes that aren't made any longer that are some of the most accurate lathes of their kind in the world. And so consequently, we're filling a need of something that people want by remanufacturing a lathe that you can't get anymore that's extremely needed in defense and medical and aerospace. We also sell machine tools, a lot of which are computerized, to different manufacturing concerns throughout the Midwest. And then we also sell pre-owned equipment that's computerized around the country so that people that, you know, may not want to or justify a $250,000 or a $300,000 piece of equipment, they might buy it from us used with us certifying it and making certain that it's safe first, accurate second, and reliable third. And it might be anywhere from half to 30 to 50% of what something like that would be new.
Okay. I imagine there's plenty of opportunities for people to learn how to manufacture something in this country. But you're in the field, so what's the landscape look like out there?
Well, one of the best resources that I name in my book for data is the Manufacturing Institute out of Washington, D.C. It's a subsector of NAM, which is the National Association of Manufacturers. And they have all the statistics there, but some of the statistics, just to give you an idea, is we have 600,000 positions in skilled positions. That's the That's the key. Skilled positions that can't be filled in this country. And over the next 10 or so years, there's about 2.5 million positions that needed to be filled and may not be able to be filled. And you know, a lot of people are talking and have been talking about the amount of manufacturing that's gone to China. But there's still a great deal of manufacturing in the U.S., and our culture simply doesn't understand that. If you took our manufacturing economy in the U.S. by itself and you compared it to all the world economies for each country around the world, we're still number 8, the 8th largest economy in the world, if you just took the manufacturing component of our economy. So there's a lot of opportunity, and we have schools, and I was talking on the south side of Chicago talking to some young men in a class, and you know, and I asked them if they know anything about manufacturing. Out of 20 young men, maybe one or two will raise their hands. So there's a lot of opportunity, and there's a great need, which I made the analogy, if you have one Chicago Bulls championship ticket to go to a championship game, and you have 1,000 people that want that ticket, what happens to the cost of that ticket? And of course, they all said, well, the price goes up. I said, well, that's the case we have in manufacturing, is that people, there's a great need and there's a short supply, so the salaries are going up. The average salary in manufacturing, now there's certainly way lower salaries and way higher salaries, but the average salary in manufacturing is with benefits is about $82,000 a year. Now, that's for a very skilled position with, you know, basically mid-career level opportunity. So if young people looked at, you know, the opportunities that are available and the actual salary and the positions open, what people don't realize is that the baby boomers in manufacturing are now retiring in waves. And that exit of the workforce exceeds the amount of the workforce that has been diminished by jobs going to China. There's also a case where a friend of mine, Harry Mosier, has something that he initiated called the Reshoring Initiative, which means he's convincing companies that make sense, prudent sense, to bring manufacturing back from China, to which I would say, all right, we need to have a game plan together to let our culture and society know that there's more manufacturing jobs coming back.
You touched on baby boomers. Now, true, there are a lot of baby boomers retiring, but there are also a lot of baby boomers that are working at Walmart, that are working at Popeye's Chicken or some fast food joint because they can't afford to retire. Either the retirement isn't enough and they've got to work to supplement it or something, whatever. There's a bunch of 50 and 60-year-olds out here or even older. And I don't know, and this matter of fact, just this morning, I think I'm reading a headline here. The virus could deplete Social Security this decade. Now, I haven't read the article, whatever that means. So for a person that's still healthy enough to let's say, find a new career, midlife. I'm going to put it 40, 50, 60 years old. Any steps to start get themselves educated and to get into something where they can, let's say, if they live another 20-plus years, they don't have to struggle. What steps should they take? And they decided to, once again, their favorite widget, they decide they want to learn how to make that.
Well, there's all sorts of learning opportunities. And during this time of stay-at-home orders and et cetera, I mentioned, John Saunders and his program. There's also a guy out of California called Titan Gilroy. And Titan Gilroy, he has a program he teaches people manufacturing for free. There's a program, and if you look up, it's either Titans of CNC. If you look that up in Titans of CNC Academy, there's something online that he has, and I was interviewed him in Chapter 3 of my book, and he can teach quite a bit of what manufacturing is and why it's so exciting and why it would interest you. As far as a person that's midlife and is looking to change and go into something else, there's numerous certifications that are around this country. Sometimes it's for machining, sometimes it's for welding, it's for, you know, all different things that can give you a skill set in a very shortened period of time that can then be transferable into a manufacturing opportunity and career. There's one other thing that I would suggest, and that is, you know, there's the program called How It's Made. You know, if you're not sure if this interests you, How It's Made will show you. It doesn't show you careers. That's the only thing I unfortunately don't like about it, but it shows you the manufacturing process, and it shows you all sorts of different things that are made and how they're made. So that's something that is a learning opportunity. There's an organization called SME, which is the Society of Manufacturing Engineering, and they have a university online called Tooling University, Tooling U. And you can actually online take classes and learn about manufacturing processes, you know, right on your laptop, right on your computer, and that is something that's on a charge basis. So those are just a few things. Those are just a few things that I would say.
I'm taking notes while you're speaking.
Mm-hmm.
We got a caller here for you. We're speaking with Terry M. Iverson. He's written a book, America's Greatest Champion. It's available on Amazon. Let's go to our phone lines, 314. Your mic is open.
Yeah, how you doing?
Hi there,
Illy.
Good, Pionki.
Yeah, I heard him make the statement about the things that this president has said, which I agree with, about bringing manufacturing back to the United States. Anything that's being produced in China, they should put tariffs on to make them absurdly high, whereas it will allow manufacturing to kick back off here in the United States. As we've seen, you know, at least 100 different manufacturers reopen during his first 3 years. Mm-hmm. And when one look at the American company that's now owned by, say, China, from GE, Hoover, you got Forms, they're trying to take possession of energy production, seaports. Those items and many others should be classified as national security interests and should not be allowed to go into a foreign enemy. So, yes, I would love to see more manufacturing, and I promote more manufacturing in going back into the United States. Anything that they are producing, I mean, look at the pharmaceuticals. Look at the electronics. Those things need to be redone here in the United States. Immigrants that's here working on work visas, when their visa expire, they should be made to go back home. Train Americans for those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And another point, I don't think that this country should allow foreign pilots to be trained in our latest tactical military aircraft like we've seen that went on in Pensacola, Florida, where you had some Saudi pilots turn on the base and kill some Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So, what's your comment on that?
Well, there's a lot of good points you've made. First of all, when you talk about manufacturing, and our ability to, let's just say, let's start with to defend ourselves. I come from the machine tool industry, and unfortunately, over the years, the machine tool industry, which, you know, the machine tool industry makes the machines that makes everything else. So the baseline that we have in this country has diminished greatly. And so back when I got into the business in the early 1980s, there was quite the concern that our machine tool industry would be decimated to the point where we would have a very tough time to defend ourselves because we wouldn't be able to make the necessary items to defend ourselves and would rely on other countries too much. Now, having gone through the COVID situation, the COVID-19 crisis, I think our culture is starting to understand and realize something that those of us in manufacturing have known for a long time, is that if we buy too many of our goods from abroad, depending on who we're buying from and what side of the philosophical and equation in terms of agreement or disagreement with policies, we could be in a position where we need something, you know, and, you know, for the livelihood and safety of our citizens and not be able to get it or not be able to produce it. The ingenuity in the U.S. in the American worker is absolutely, you know, doesn't take a second seat to, you know, any culture in the world. Our ingenuity and our ability to invent and design and at one point even now to manufacture is tops in the world. So in terms of, I think your point with, you know, certainly with instructing, you know, people from another country that maybe haven't been vetted properly, it's a very valid point. But it's kind of off topic what I've been involved in for my whole career. So I think there's no better the reason I wrote the book is to educate the market and the people looking for long-term good paying careers and to strengthen to try to make a difference in our culture, the importance of manufacturing in our US, the fact that it is responsible for our middle class. And the better job we can do on programs like this and through my book and other books and programs, which I try to heighten and make aware of people aware in my book, culture and our society will understand the importance and gravitate, not because they're making a conscious decision to stay out of it. They simply didn't even know about it.
Well, you know, another thing,
Barry,
too.
Go ahead, Peter.
And if I could throw this. Is that our education system in the United States is terrible, especially in your inner city schools. Those students are being raked over the coal. They're not even given a chance, whereas they can contribute to the overall outcome, positive outcome, and strengthening of the United States. And those education systems need to be, you know, tore down. And parents need to be allowed, those that are knowingly of what's going on, to put their child where they can be educated in the area that the parent and family think is best. And what your book is about, it's about the introduction of this industry that normally, though, goes unnoticed. I remember the days when a tool and die maker was a top profession. And, of course, with the innovation of technology like AutoCAD, and today we see in 3D printing. But that still doesn't mean that young people can't learn those disciplines and be able to carry on in the manufacturing like never seen before. So I agree with you. If you look at World War II, would I battle in the Pacific? If it wasn't the ability of United States manufacturing to come on like it did, we may be speaking a different language today. Anyway, I'm going to continue to listen.
Can I add one thing to that?
Sure.
I won't say that our education system is terrible. I will say that our education system needs to evolve to what the market is requiring. I'll say that. I will say that that there is a lot of these technical schools closed down. A lot of the programs in high schools were closed up. And that happened in the early to mid 80s when someone made the sad commentary that we were going to be a service-based economy. What I will say is that Project Lead the Way is coming back into high schools. That's project-based learning. You know, a lot of our young people don't learn the same. I was an AP student, but I learned visually much better than I ever did, you know, reading a book or looking at something on a blackboard. What I will say is that Vince Bertrand is president of Project Lead the Way, and he was interviewed in the book, and that was intentional. And schools are being measured by you know, primarily one way, and that's how many of their students are going to college. And I think that's unfortunate because there's occasionally locally, Dr. Laz Lopez at Wheeling High School in Wheeling, Illinois, he kind of went the other direction, regardless of how he was being measured at his high school, because the fit around his community was perfect for manufacturing-based employment, either straight out of high school or through a community college and then into the workforce. So I think career readiness and relevancy is important, and I think I would challenge our schools and our government to measure schools differently, and I would also challenge our parents to be more open to investigating what the manufacturing sector is all about. Manufacturing Day is every October in this country, and manufacturers throughout every community open their doors for young people and parents to come into their buildings and witness and understand what manufacturing is today.
Terry, let me ask you this. You mentioned Manufacturing Day. Are there things like manufacturing camps, you know, like there are computer camps for kids, soccer camps for kids? Anybody out there innovative enough to have put out a manufacturing camp to introduce manufacturing to, you know, the kids?
That's a great question. Yes, there is. I mean, there's lots of camps, but the one that I can, you know, to be brief, that I think does a great job, the Fabricators and Manufacturers Association, otherwise known as FMA, they were the organization that actually started Manufacturing Day, and this goes back 6 or 7 years ago, and we actually had a meeting at my office of people all around the country that they were at, and out of that conversation, they divulged that they were going to do a Manufacturing Day. But having said that, they have a foundation called Nuts, Bolts, and Thingamajigs, and Nuts, Bolts, and Thingamajigs has camps throughout the country. So that would be the easiest example that I can say that there's camps to introduce young people to manufacturing. The other thing I'll say is there's a business model out of Wisconsin that I write about in my book at Oliva Strum, Wisconsin school district. They actually have a manufacturing company inside their school. So I'd like to challenge the high schools out there that you can actually have a manufacturing company. They call it Cardinal Manufacturing up in Wisconsin, where the freshmen, sophomore, juniors, and seniors make the product, sell the product, run the machines, program the machines, maintain the machines, bill out the invoicing. And so they have a manufacturing company within the high school. So that's another good example of, if we think differently, or to coin a term out of Vince Bertrand's book, his book's called Dream Differently. I think those are the best examples I can give you.
Boy, okay, you got me busy typing notes here on my phone. Okay, let's get back to the book. Let's see, Chapter 5, could you discuss a little bit about Chapter 5 in the book?
Sure. You got me talking about key influencers on teenagers. That's the one you're talking about?
Exactly.
Well, what I talk about in Chapter 5 is that there's positive influences and there's unfortunately negative influences as well. And so what I try to do is I try to hit on both. I interview Vince Bertram about Project Lead the Way and how there's many, different ways to learn. And that's a certain segment of the student population learns much better with project-based learning. I also talk about the makerspace movement and how that's gaining momentum in this country. And that's a tremendous positive for young people in this country. And then I also talk about some of the unfortunate things in our country that not only students need to be aware of, but parents as well. There's the opioid crisis right now, and there's a young man that unfortunately, I coached him and his rest of his siblings when they were young, and his name is Mikey Santini. And he unfortunately became a heroin addict and unfortunately passed as a result of that at the age of 25 years old. So I call out, or I kind of, want to make sure that I speak out to parents and say, look, your young people, our young people are our most precious commodity and our most precious thing in life. And what we need to do is we need to, no matter what race or ethnicity, no matter what background, and no matter what culture you reside in, affluent or not, there's distractions and unfortunate circumstances, and the heroin epidemic that we have right now in this country, opioid crisis that we have, is really making huge voids in our young people and killing a lot of our young people. So I try to talk about both positive and negatives to be aware of in terms of influencers.
Okay. Still in the book, skipping around, and this is something I heard on the podcast that you were on. I guess it was Monday.
It was.
Chapter 11, Women in Manufacturing. Before you answer that, go into the meat of that chapter. I watch a bunch of YouTube videos, I guess, like everybody else. But for instance, I ordered a tent, and found out the tent was under a brand name, which is owned by Walmart, and the tent was actually made. And Walmart must make about $2 billion a year off of what I bought, but which is okay. But it was made in Bangladesh, so I went online and watched, videos of, tent makers and whatnot. I'm social networking with tent makers in different parts of the world now. But I noticed that there are a lot of female tent makers out there that live in Bangladesh. China subcontracts a lot of work out to various parts of Asia or Africa. So going to chapter 11, and like I said, I noticed a lot of women who are sewing. And my mother sewed. My mother passed at 92. I don't see that many women sewing these days or making things. Maybe I'm an idealist, I think they should. But chapter 11, what's that about in your book? What do you cover in that chapter in your book, chapter 11, Women in Manufacturing?
Well, what I try to cover in chapter 11 is that there's tremendous opportunity for women in manufacturing. And, you see a lot of things made around the world where are very labor intensive. And as a result, you'll find that those type of, that it's hard to automate them. It's hard to have, a high degree of technology involved. So you'll find different parts of the world where the labor rate is a lot less. And yes, it's very true that it's a common perception, at least from what I've seen, is the dexterity that women have, with their hands, that they're very good at making things. They're very good, and their dexterity is superior in what they can do, and this is just a generalization. But consequently, what in this country, you know, in chapter 11, I try to give some examples of some young women that have done well, one or two of which I've known since they were, you know, a small child, and helped mentor them. And then I've also talked to women organizations. One of the Manufacturing Institute past presidents, Jennifer McNally, she was a big advocate of women in manufacturing and started something called the STEP program. You know, they honor women in manufacturing around the country. And then Allison Grialis is president of Women in Manufacturing Organization. So I highlight their organization and her voice. I also talk about how in this country, or in certain cultures, our culture, when young women would go into, say, engineering classes in high school, many times their male counterparts, you know, may be a little bit less mature than the young women in the class, would not harass them, but kid them about being involved in engineering. So the dropout rate was very high. Elk Grove High School in Chicago area, they have a female-only intro to engineering class. And what they find is that by not having the boys in the class, that the retention by the young women will be longer and higher, and they'll stay in that classification or that interest. So there's a lot of things that I try to I talk a little bit briefly about the Me Too movement and how, you know, this is the female gender's opportunity to have a voice and stand up and take advantage of, you know, a need in our industry, which is, you know, phenomenally vast. And there's opportunities if they're interested to get involved in the manufacturing sector. And we, those of us, male or otherwise, in the industry, need to embrace that and help facilitate more women entering the manufacturing sector.
Okay. Another question. Mm-hmm. 3D printers, anybody can go on Amazon and get one. How do you see that affecting manufacturing, at least at-home manufacturing? That's a term I just made up. The 3D printer in homes, you know, like everybody's got a copy machine at home now. So what about 3D printers?
Well, I think 3D printing is, you know, this, you know, I got involved in manufacturing in 1980. So everything back, if you go back that far, was what you would now call subtractive manufacturing. You would take a piece of metal or plastic or whatever, and you would take away from it to make a component. When 3D printing came in, it's probably been around maybe 10 years now, it's called additive manufacturing. So the term subtractive manufacturing didn't really even exist until the term additive, and then they refer back to the old way of making a part as subtractive. So the fact that you can get involved into either CAD or design, because you have to have a drawing, like, you know, a engineer drawing or a computer drawing, to be able to give that drawing to the 3D printer. There's a huge engineering and manufacturing component to 3D printing, and it is absolutely a great opportunity for people to learn and for people to embrace and hopefully follow a path into manufacturing because of 3D printing. So I think it's, you know, most high schools, even if they don't have a manufacturing program, are starting out with 3D printers because A, they're affordable, and B, they don't take up much space. So I think 3D printing could be a total game changer in this country in terms of, you know, enticing and informing and educating people about manufacturing. And during this whole COVID-19 crisis, school districts in the Illinois area that have been making protective equipment for the medical field for the COVID-19 crisis, for the responders and the healthcare workers and et cetera, on 3D printing, on 3D printers at their schools.
Yeah,
well, you know, another thing, they have scanners. They utilize scanners with the 3D printers. Mm-hmm. They have scanners that you can scan the whole side of an automobile. I've seen those. And
they do.
Apparently that works out pretty good. People scanning all sorts of things, but the technology has came along. I don't know about the metal, or should I say, it's an artificial metal. It's not hard. It's steel, of course, but you know that scan object can be used to make a mold, which could be used to accept molten metal. Just a little lengthy progress. But hey, it's a lot of things that can be done. It's been done. And got to get ready.
Terry, you've got, trying to promote your book here, so I figure you're the best person to promote it, 14 chapters. So give us an overview of the book and where we can purchase the book.
Well, there's a couple different places you can purchase it. First of all, let me say I have it in paperback, hardback, ebook, and audiobook. You had noted earlier that you can get it on Amazon, which you can. You can also get it on Audible on the as far as the audiobook. I also have a website that's called championnow.org. I think you can get all of those either directly or indirectly through championnow.org also, but the hardback, I just got an order on the hardback earlier before the show. That can only be purchased through championnow.org. But as far as the actual, if I had to explain to the audience, I try to reach out to four different audiences in the book. I try to reach out to students. I try to reach out to parents. I try to reach out to industry, and I try to reach out to education. And so ultimately, at some point, I'll have four separate books for each audience, but I felt it was much easier to write one book for all four instead of writing four separate books. But that is in my plans, is to break it down to four smaller books. And students, I try to educate them about the opportunities and that everybody learns differently, and you know, it's okay if you're not interested in manufacturing, just at least know that it exists and then make an educated decision about it. I try to talk to parents about the cost of sending their child. They feel that they're going to pay for the education, or even if their student or their child's going to pay for the education, that there's a good paying career that doesn't have to cost $250,000. It can cost, much, much less, you know, maybe $10,000 or $20,000 or less. I try to talk to industry members and tell them that they need to reach out to educators and let them know in their area, their local high school, that there's jobs that are available, that they're hiring. And then I try to talk to educators about how to be open to being career ready, your students to be career ready, not just college ready. Because if all we're doing is educating our students for, you know, to go to college, we're only really satisfying, you know, a minority of the students instead of the majority. And in the reality, that's what's happening right now. So in a nutshell, that's what the book's about. And you can certainly get it on Amazon. It's called Finding America's Greatest Champion. And then Champion Now is my 501c3 that is to promote manufacturing. There's all sorts of podcasts and videos and interviews and data that's on that site, and all the proceeds from every book that I sell, regardless of what format, all go to Champion Now, the 501c3.
Okay, that's terrific. Now, I haven't stepped in a physical bookstore in a while. I used to love Borders, but Borders closed now. And I purchase most of my books now, you know, at Amazon, Kindle. But I spent over the years quite a bit of time in a personal finance section. Mm-hmm. Are there many books out there right now on just the fundamentals of manufacturing or anything on manufacturing?
You know, I don't know I think the answer is yes, but I don't know how much of that you'll find in a bookstore, because it's not the mainstream that I'm aware of. But I will say this: I've had a number of people say that they would want this book at their local library. And so what I might challenge some of your listeners is, you know, you can also call your local library and request that they purchase it so that people in your community can go into the library and actually either check it out and read it or, you know, get some of the information while they're at the library. So I've had people from around the country do that. And so that's another thought.
Yeah, that is a good idea, because I spent over the decades quite a bit of time in the personal finance section, and I can't recall any of the books, at least the ones that I purchased, that even hinted at making something. One book by Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Kid, Poor Kid. He talked about different ways of learning, which you've touched on here today. But he didn't, and I bought about five or six of his books. He didn't get into making things specifically. Okay. And then even one of the great all-time best-selling self-help books, or motivational books, depending on how you look at it, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. He gave, I think, the 13 principles, what he called the 13 principles of success. I was like 25 when I read that book. Read the covers off of it. Read the back covers off it. But looking at it now, this is why I like your book. He gave what he called the 13 principles of success, but the examples that he gave, well, one of the principles that he didn't give was making something, manufacturing. Now, the people that he mentioned in the book that he, you know, took these 13 principles from, you know, was one of the principles was imagination, the mystery of sex, transmutation, stuff like that. Harvey's Firestone, Henry Ford, Andrew Carnegie, and anybody else he mentioned, all of those guys were manufacturers or assemblers.
Right.
Because Henry Ford basically assembled cars. So, and I noticed that a lot of, you know, I haven't been in that section in a while, but that's what I like really refreshing about your book and even the interview I heard you on Monday, because it's well, now I guess I'm on a different wavelength. I can start looking for, I know where to go find that material now. Anyway, that's why I'm so glad you wrote the book. Now, we're in the COVID mode. Some of these states are, I guess, by the end of this month or by the middle of next month, state by state, location by location, will be slowly coming out. Well, I'm guessing, because they've changed up on us before. Slowly coming out of this pandemic mode. Are there any places where you'll be speaking or having workshops or retreats, let's say, in the fall of the year? I'm gonna eliminate the summer for now.
Well, I think the one thing that I'll say is, at least for now, every even year, which this is an even year, one of the biggest opportunities in the country is called the International Manufacturing and Technology Show. And that's in Chicago at McCormick Place, and it's in September. And as far as I know, that's still being planned, and it's still, you know, going on as always planned. And there's something called the Student Summit. And the Student Summit, for years, IMTS wouldn't allow anyone under 18 to to go to the show and to learn. You had to be over 18. And I mentioned this in the book that, you know, some years back, probably in the mid-90s, I think it was, maybe early 90s, they changed that. And then that gradually parlayed into they, you know, not only encouraged young people, but then had a student summit. So last year I had a table and a booth down at McCormick Place in September in the student summit. I couldn't always be there 100% of the time, but because I have to, you know, help other manufacturers that I represent at their booth. But that's one location that I plan to be at. Right now, I've been chasing the podcast route and trying to inform people digitally, you know, and you've been gracious in inviting me on to do that as well. So that would be the only place that I would say in the fall is at IMTS in Chicago in September.
All right, great.
Well, you know,
Bianchi.
There's another expo that goes on in Atlanta yearly. It's called the International Poultry and Food Processing Expo. It is tremendously large, and you have manufacturers from all over the world displaying their food processing equipment and implementations. It's there at, Andrew Young, the World Dome there in Atlanta, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
That happens in January, by the way.
So the next one's 21.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Hopefully everything will be on track by then. Well, Terry, any thing that you want to promote or closing statements?
I think the one thing I would want to promote is, if there's any manufacturers out there that are, you know, having Manufacturing Day. I think that, having a resource to be able to hand out to families as they come through, that's one of the things that I hope for my book is a resource for them. If there's any, you know, associations, I would be glad to consider talking or speaking at an association meeting or event going forward and using the book to be able to inform and educate people there. But, if people go to my Champion Now website. Mm-hmm. Pardon?
Something just popped into my mind. this is not directed towards you, but how can others make manufacturing sexy? Because that's kind of that would bring more people in, particularly younger people in. And I'll give an example. Like when I'm speaking to guys, even the old dogs, I tell people instead of because you got to meet people where they are. Instead of like if somebody's interested in sports. I might thought because I meeting them where they are, like how much, who's the highest paid player in the NBA? Now, more than likely, they're going to name somebody who actually dribbles the ball. Very rarely will they name the team owner, but nobody has ever, as of yet, named the manufacturers who make this stuff. So I've coined the term sports manufacturing. I consider that a sexy way to meet people to get their attention. So, in your opinion, how could we more people make manufacturing sexy?
Well, I think it's a very, very point on question, and thanks for asking it. I think that one of the people in my book, Bob Weisite, a friend of mine, he talks about that all of us in manufacturing need to do a better job at educating and informing our circle of influence about what we do. Funny that you use that exact term. A friend of mine, an acquaintance of mine out of Canada, she actually wrote a book, How can we make manufacturing sexy? And for a very small component of it, she interviewed me for a very small component of it. And but she came out of the manufacturing sector and was laid off when there was these, you know, economic times that were recessionary type times. And then she decided to, you know, interview people, and I happened to be one of them, and write a book. And so she actually wrote a book to that effect.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, all right. I'll be looking that up today as well, adding that to my reading list. All right. If people want to get in touch with you, well, you already told, as closing out, how can they get in touch with you and get the book one more time?
Well, probably the easiest way to get in touch with me is one of my two emails or my website. The championnow.org website is probably the easiest way. But then on an email, you can reach me at terry@championnow.org or my company email, which is first initial T Iverson at iversonandco.com. And then I do have a Facebook page for Iverson and Company and Champion Now. And I also have Twitter feeds for Iverson and Company and Champion Now as well.
Okay. All right. Well, Terry, thank you for coming on. Like I said, I heard you on Monday on another podcast. And I went to their website and was impressed. I can stay on that for the rest of the year. When I went and saw you, loaded a sample to my phone, I'll be purchasing it. So thank you for coming on. Thank you, people, for listening. Thank you for callers calling in. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day.
Thank you very much.